This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ben Stiller, has starred in a wide range of movies, mostly comedies, from big hits like There's Something About Mary, Meet the Parents, and Night at the Museum, to indie films like The Royal Tenenbaums and Your Friends and Neighbors. He directed and starred in the comedies Zoolander and Tropic Thunder, and produced and starred in Dodgeball. He's the son of comic actors Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller. In the new film Greenberg, Stiller plays Roger Greenberg, a 40-year-old whose life hasn't turned out the way he'd hoped. He's just had a midlife crisis slash mental breakdown. After recovering in a hospital, he's spending a few weeks at his brother's house while his brother and family are on a trip to Vietnam. When people he meets ask what he's been doing, he tells them he's trying to do nothing for a while. In this scene, he's with Florence, the young, attractive woman who works as the personal assistant for his brother's family. Florence is played by Greta Gerwig.
I'm impressed by you.
In what way?
I don't know. I mean, you seem really fine doing nothing. It's like you don't feel all the pressure to be successful. I mean, by other people's standards.
You know, I almost had a record deal when I got out of college. I haven't done nothing.
Cool.
I want to be doing nothing. I'm doing nothing deliberately.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that I could do nothing and be that cool with everything.
Roger Greenberg is very cynical and alienated, and that really comes out when he's the only 40-year-old at a party of people in their 20s.
The thing about you kids is you're all kind of insensitive. I'm glad I grew up when I did, because your parents were too perfect at parenting. All that baby Mozart and Dan Zane songs. You're so sincere and interested in things. There's a confidence in you guys that's horrifying. You're all ADD and carpal tunnel. You wouldn't know agoraphobia if it bit you in the ass, and it makes you mean. You know, you say things to someone like me who's older and smarter with this life air. I'm freaked out by you kids. I hope I die before I end up meeting one of you in a job interview.
Ben Stiller, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film. I really liked it a lot. Your character is kind of taking a break from life after having a nervous breakdown. Why do you think he had a nervous breakdown?
I guess he did. I don't think he looks at it as that. I think I even have trouble saying it. Uh-huh. You know, I feel like he just spent some time in the hospital. I think, you know, he had a psychosomatic condition where he couldn't move his leg. And it probably was a result of not dealing with a lot of things over the years. You know, he's a guy who hasn't really gotten to where he wanted to be in life and hasn't really been able to accept that. And he's very critical of everybody else in the world. And he's really probably too smart for his own good. And so when the movie picks up, he's sort of at a place where he's having to accept some things in his life that he's denied for a long time.
Like he doesn't know whether he really is a carpenter or that's just his day job.
He was in a band when he got out of college, and the band had a moment in time where they were playing out and probably doing okay, and then they had a shot at a record deal, and he was the one in the band who didn't want to sign the deal. And probably thinking there'd be a lot more offers, and he was pretty self-important and very idealistic, and then it didn't happen. And since then, he's been just slowly, year by year, sort of just going through his life, and he's become a carpenter to make money, and it's just not really happened for him the way he thought it was going to happen.
Having been successful at a very young age, what do you relate to about this character?
Well, I think everybody's had failures in their life and decisions that you regret and relationships that didn't work out. And I think I've been really fortunate in my life to have had great things happen and friendships and love and family in my life over the years. But I still had those bad decisions and things I've done in the past that I still regret. But for Greenberg, he hasn't had a lot of successes since the bad decisions, and he hasn't had anything to sort of temper that, and so it's a lot harder to get through the day. So I can identify with, on that level, I think there are a lot of people I know who have had bad luck and are very talented and good people, and it just hasn't worked out for them, or, you know, their life isn't quite what they want it to be, and they have to figure out a way to get through the day, and we all have to. I mean, I have days like that too, and I think it was just a matter of empathizing with this guy, not looking at him as a guy who had really screwed up or anything, but just a guy who was trying the best he can to, you know, just to get through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ben Stiller, and he's starring in the new movie, Greenberg. Let's talk about some of the movies that you've made. And let's start with Tropic Thunder, which you co-wrote, you directed, and you starred in. And it's such a funny premise. It's about actors making a jungle war movie.
It's a Vietnam movie.
Yeah, a Vietnam movie, where an elite army team is sent to rescue one man. And it's both the movie within the movie that's being made, but, you know, we also see the actors who are making that movie and
right.
how they get into character and all of that. So it's a parody of movies and of actors. Were Vietnam War movies important to you when you were starting out?
Some of my favorite films are that genre. I mean, I remember seeing Platoon and just being deeply affected by it. Love Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now. You know, those movies, in terms of generationally, those movies were very important movies because that era was when I was younger, and those are the movies that influenced me a lot. You know, I in a way, I wanted to be doing those kinds of movies. I think that's a lot of what Tropic Thunder is, like my sort of stab at being able to do one of those films.
Did you ever try for real to be in one of those war films?
I had a meeting with Oliver Stone for Platoon. I think I was like 20 or 21. I had a go-see, as they call it.
What was it like?
I was doing a play at the time, and I think he thought I looked too clean-cut or something. He said something like, oh, you looked at my picture, oh, you're cute, or something like that. And then...
Not knowing that you'd eventually be Zoolander.
Yeah, exactly. I think he was being generous.
You get some of this so perfectly right. Like there's a scene toward the beginning where your character in the movie, your character, the actor in the movie shot, is getting shot up.
Right.
And as the bullets riddle his body, it's shot in slow motion and he's just kind of almost like dancing, you know, as the bullets hit him, and with the music behind him, it's the music you always hear
right.
when that happens. Can you talk to me about that shot and why you knew you had to use it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was pretty much directly ripped off from Platoon. I mean, that was, you know, that's that incredible moment in Platoon near the end with Willem Dafoe and, you know, the idea.
At his most Christ-like.
Yes, for sure. He was definitely went into that pose. And, you know, in this, the context of Tropic Thunder, it's like it's a movie that's being made, obviously, post-Platoon and, you know, it's probably very derivative and, you know, because they've already done that. And it's an actor trying to be taken seriously. And he's probably saw that movie and he's doing his best guy getting riddled with bullets in a Christ-like pose ending. And it's not really doing that great at it. So, you know, it's sort of the idea of... a guy trying to do something because, you know, in the movie, the character's an action star and he hasn't been taken seriously and he really wants some credibility. And I think that's a lot of what the movie's about, is actors taking advantage of people's, you know, real-life people's suffering to try to further their own careers.
Yes, and one example of that is that your character has also starred in a movie called Simple Jack.
That's right.
And yeah. Why don't you describe what Simple Jack is?
Simple Jack is a mentally challenged farmhand who can talk to animals. And it was the character in the movie that I played, Tug Speedman. It was his attempt to do a role that was going to be taken seriously and win him an Oscar. And it ended up having the exact opposite effect and being derided by everybody, critics and audiences, and being a huge failure.
Now, I want to play a scene from the film. And in this scene from Tropic Thunder, you're in the jungle making the movie, and you're talking to another actor played by Robert Downey Jr., and he plays an actor who's like this serious, multi-Oscar-winning actor, and he's so into getting into character and being De Niro-ish about it that he's gotten this special... pigmentation procedure so that he can look African-American because he's playing a black man in this.
Yeah, that's right. And he never goes out of character.
And he never goes out of character. So here you are, you know, walking through the jungle with him, and you're both out of character here. You're not, but so you're just talking as yourself, but he's still, you know, quote, talking black because he never gets out of character. And what you're talking about is the simple Jack role. And so this ended up being a very controversial scene because of the use of the word retarded. So I just want to warn our listeners, for anybody who finds that word like really, you know, insulting, that this is a comedy, this is a parody. You know it's an insulting word, and you're using it. You, the writer, director of this movie, are using it knowing that. So here's the scene.
There were times when I was doing Jack that I actually felt retarded, like really retarded.
I mean, I brushed my teeth retarded. I rode bus retarded.
Damn.
In a weird way, I had to sort of just free myself up to believe that it was okay to be stupid or dumb.
To be a moron.
Yeah.
To be moronical.
Exactly. To be a moron.
An imbecile.
Yeah.
Like the dumbest motherfucker that ever lived.
When I was playing the character.
When you was a character.
Yeah, I mean, as Jack, definitely.
Yeah. Jack. Stupid-ass Jack. Trying to come back from that.
In a weird way, it was almost like I had to sort of fool my mind into believing that it wasn't retarded. And by the end of the whole thing, I was like, wait a minute, you know? I flushed so much out, how am I going to jumpstart it up again? It's just like...
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
You was farting in bathtubs and laughing your ass off.
Yeah.
But Simple Jack thought he was smart, or rather didn't think he was retarded, so he can't afford to play retarded being a smart actor. Playing a guy who ain't smart but thinks he is, that's tricky.
Tricky.
It's like working with mercury. It's high science, man. It's art form.
Yeah.
You an artist.
That's what we do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hats off for going there. Especially knowing the Academy is about that.
Wait. About what?
You serious? You don't know. Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman... Rayman, look retarded, act retarded, not retarded. Count two picks, cheat cards. Autistic, sure, not retarded. You got Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Slow, yes, retarded, maybe, braces on his legs, but he charmed the pants off next to him and he won a ping pong competition. That ain't retarded. And he was a goddamn war hero. Right. You know any retarded war heroes? You went full retard, man. Never go full retard. You don't buy that? Yeah, Sean Penn, 2001, I am saying. Remember? Went full retard. Went home empty-handed.
So that's my guest Ben Stiller with Robert Downey Jr. in a scene from Tropic Thunder, which Ben Stiller directed, co-wrote, and starred in. So what kind of blowback did you get from that scene?
Got a little blowback. to me it was pretty clear that this was... In the context of the movie, is, you know, ridiculing the actors who were taking advantage of other people's real struggles to try to further their own careers. So to me, that was always clear in the context of these actors speaking in a way about very uninformed way about something and sounding like kids talking about a mental disability, and all of it being in the context of talking about, you know, how you win an Oscar for doing that. So I don't think it could have been any clearer what the context was, but I guess some people still had a problem with it.
Now, Robert Downey Jr.'s character, I feel like a lot of people didn't get it. You know, a lot of people said, it's so wrong for a white actor to be playing a black man. But that was the whole point. This is a parody of somebody who's so into, like, his method that he has the pigmentation change so he can, like, be black. And he's in character.
I think that was the point in the movie, was that, you know, there's no reason that a white actor should be playing a black character.
Exactly, right.
Other than his own ego to think that he could do it. And, you know, and that's so that was why it was ridiculous. And the fact that he ended up actually getting an Oscar nomination for it, to me, is sort of the ultimate irony of the whole thing, which I was very happy about. But, I mean, that's, you know, and I think only Robert could really pull that off, too.
Now, you know, he's trying to be very like De Niro in the movie in terms of, like, going to extremes to physically embody the character he's playing. You've actually worked with De Niro in Meet the Parents. So that's not the kind of movie you'd have to go to extremes for. It's like a family comedy. But what did you learn about how he gets into character by actually working with him? Because you're obviously fascinated by those kinds of extremes that some people go to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think De Niro's obviously, you know, he just had a total commitment to those roles that he did when he needed to get into that headspace.
You know, like Raging Bull.
Yeah, like Raging Bull. And I sometimes ask him about that. Like, did you know, I heard that you used to run from your hotel to the studio in the morning, you know, to do your road work. And you know, and it's true. He did all that stuff. And but he also has a really good sense of humor, too, about all of it. But I think he just has, like, he doesn't know how to do it any other way. I think that's just, you know, the way that he approaches it is he has to understand where the character is coming from and feel as connected as possible. I would assume, every once in a while I'll get up the courage to ask him stuff about movies he's been in, but you know, he just has a, you know, it's just about integrity, and I think, and feeling like he wants to be as close to the character as possible.
Was there anything really surprising about doing scenes with him?
Well, just how funny he is. I mean, that to me, the first time we did it and Meet the Parents, I remember doing the first scene and how funny and how reactive he is, because he really listens. And there was a scene where I'm meeting him for the first time, and we're standing in front of his house, and I was, you know, shaking his hand, saying hi to him, and then I looked at something in the house behind him because I was looking up at the house, and he literally turned all the way around to look at what I was looking at in the house. It wasn't even in the script or anything, and I immediately started cracking up because first of all, I was nervous because I was in a scene with Robert De Niro for the first time ever, but also I couldn't believe how sensitive he was to what I was doing and how he just picked up on it and went with it. I think he has a really great sense of being in the moment, and I think he just has a sense of humor, and he's always had it in his serious roles. I mean, you go back to Mean Streets and all those movies, very funny in those movies, and you always enjoy and laugh at him in any of these films, even while he's scary and intimidating and, you know, all those other things. So that, it's not surprising to me that he has that sense of humor and the comedy stuff, too.
In Tropic Thunder, which you directed and co-wrote, there's a scene in which the special effects guy, you know, the special effects guy in this movie,
yes,
set in Vietnam, he misunderstands a cue, and he thinks that that's the cue to, like, set off the climactic explosions. And so he sets them off. The cameras aren't rolling. Nobody's in position. In fact, some of the actors are in jeopardy of getting, like, blown up. And it's a very funny scene. But I'm wondering what it was like for you to be directing a movie in which there really were explosives and you really had to blow up, right? Like, part of the set. I mean, that's a huge responsibility. People really can get hurt. It's very funny in the movie, but you had to deal with it,
right?
For real. It's not like really your thing. You don't make like big, right, big special effects movies, but
right. Well, I mean, I think it goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, is my chance to do one of those movies, you know, in a context that sort of made sense for me, because I really love those kinds of movies, and so it was really fun to have the opportunity to do that and to figure out what that process is and to get to work. First of all, safety wise, you just have to work with the best people, and that's the most important thing, and we did, and you know, so that was what it was. But the opportunity to, like, blow stuff up and to have helicopters and do all those scenes, I mean, I never had more fun as a director ever. And the hard part really wasn't shooting that stuff. I found it was really more once we got in that scene after everything, after the scene ends and the director yells cut before that explosion happens. To film a movie set, to film like the actual geography of people standing around a movie set in a scene there, that was actually harder than shooting the action scenes. Because a movie set is such a weird, amorphous place where it's just people standing around. You realize there's where the camera is, there's some lights, but then after that it's trailers, they could be anywhere, there's a craft service table where people get food, and that's it. So it's like it was actually harder to sort of navigate that cinematically and figure out how to film that, and because it just looks like an amorphous blob, and that was ended up being a much more stressful few days than all the other stuff, which we got to plan out and do storyboards on. It was very, you know, much more sort of movie like.
You have really big muscles in this movie. When did you start working out and get those, like, really big muscles?
1973 for this movie. No, I don't know. I figured I was playing the action guy in it, so I and I wasn't going to get any taller. So I should do something that showed that I could be an action guy. So I just did as many curls as I could before the camera rolled. But also, you know, the character is just such a, you know, he made a point of wearing the sleeveless vest in the movie, you know, because that's, you know, he's obviously, that's his thing. But yeah, just a lot of curls, no roids or anything like that, though.
Just the showy stuff?
And, yeah.
So do you still have what you had in that?
No, I do not. I'm a flabby 44-year-old.
I just want to play a clip from Tropic Thunder. And this is so funny. The movie starts with an ad and then three trailers. And the ad, these are all, it turns out, things that the actors within the movie have done. So it's three trailers for movies that the actors within the movie have made, and then right. An ad that one of the actors in the movie is famous for. But I didn't know that when I went to the theater, and I thought, oh, God, another ad.
Yeah, right.
And then I thought, oh, another trailer. Oh, wait a minute, Ben Stiller's in that trailer. You know, it took me a minute to realize, oh, this is the movie. This is comedy. So I want to play the trailer for your actor that we see before okay. The movie starts, and I think it will speak for itself. Here it is.
In 2013, when the Earth's rotation came to a halt,
all of North America a disaster area.
My fellow Americans, to come together.
The world called on the one man who could make a difference. When it happened again, the world called on him once more, and no one saw it coming. Three more times. Now, the one man who made a difference five times before is about to make a difference again. Only this time, it's different.
I love that. Trailers drive me crazy because sometimes they're written exactly like that. It's like one cliche after another. And sometimes
it's ridiculous.
I mean. I know. And there's always things blowing up, and there's always that Carmina Burana kind of music behind it.
Uh-huh.
What's the music that you used?
We actually scored that. We just made our own music.
Oh, I swear I've heard that in every trailer.
Yeah.
You can't have written it. I've heard it.
Like every trailer. That was really fun as a way to sort of try to set up the characters before the movie. And the only thing that frustrated me in that process was I wanted to get the real green band before each trailer, you know, that the most Motion Picture Association of America shows.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't give it to us, and it drove me crazy because I actually got the studios, like that, you know, would have like a Universal logo at the beginning. The movie, the movie was a DreamWorks movie, but Universal gave us their logo for that, and New Line gave us the logo for The Fatties, which was Jack Black's character's comedy. And Fox Searchlight gave us their logo for the Satan's Alley, which was sort of like the serious, you know, gay priest movie that Downey's character was in. So we actually won this, you know, great battle of getting these other studios to put their logos in front of a movie that wasn't from them. But then we couldn't get the Motion Picture Association to give us the real green. They told me that the shade of green that they use, we weren't allowed to use. Which I wanted to like take to the Supreme Court or something, because
right.
I felt like you can't tell me what shade of green to use.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ben Stiller, and he's starring in the new movie Greenberg. Let's talk about another movie that you co-wrote, directed, and starred in, and this is Zoolander, which came out in 2001, just a few days after 9/11. And this is such a funny film about a famous male model who's kind of on the outs. It must have been so, I don't know what word to use, but nobody was going to go see this movie after 9/11. I mean, the country was in shock and in mourning. And this is like a funny comedy about the world of modeling and fashion.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very strange. It was a really weird experience.
Can you describe what that experience was like for you?
Well, it was confusing, mainly. I mean, it was sort of surreal because, like, at the time, the last thing really that I ever thought, you know, as I was working on the movie, that there would, you know, be something, some sort of event like this that would happen that in any way would have anything to do with the release of the movie. I mean, just something you would never think of. And then, of course, when that happened, it felt really wrong in any way to be caring at all about how this event was going to affect the release of the movie. It just, you know, that just seemed, I think it just was inappropriate. And yet there's those feelings, and you've been working on something for like a year and a half, and you're like, oh my God. So I think it was the feeling of what everybody was feeling after 9/11, being a New Yorker and, you know, just experiencing that. And then on top of that, trying to figure out what to do with the movie. And, you know, there's a discussion at the studio about whether or not to release it. And, you know, when it came down to it, there was just no reason not to release it other than it might not make as much money. And to me, that was the wrong reason to not release it. You know, I felt like if anybody wanted to see a comedy, they should have the option of going to see a comedy.
I want to play a short scene, and this is a scene with your father, Jerry Stiller. And and your father plays Maury Ballstein, head of Ball's Models.
That's right.
And this is a model agency that he helped build with.
Yes, a male modeling agency.
Male modeling agency, yeah. So at this point in the movie, your character, Derek Zoolander, wants to take a break from the fashion world. And so here's you with your father, Jerry Stiller, in a scene from Zoolander.
I want to do something meaningful with my life, Maury. I have deeper thoughts on my mind. The other day, I was thinking about volunteering to help teach underprivileged children to learn how to read. And just thinking about it was the most rewarding experience I've ever had.
Derek, I don't think you're cut out for that kind of thing.
I mean, maybe I could even have my own institute. We could call it the Derek Zoolander Center for Kids Who Can't Read. Good.
What about us? We built this place together. Look out! Tushy squeeze!
Maury.
Derek, when I met you, you were a junior petite who couldn't book a goddamn Sears catalog and who couldn't turn left to save his ass. Now look at you.
I can turn left.
Yeah, right. Derek, please. Some male models go left at the end of a runway, others go right. You got a lot of gifts, but hanging a Louis just isn't one of them.
It must have given you such pleasure to say, okay, and now I'm going to write a role for my father and direct him in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I was laughing listening to that, just because he's just so... First of all, the character of Maury is so far afield from my dad's actual personality in terms of, like, you know, ever squeezing the tushy of a lady. I couldn't picture him doing that. But that was what was fun, was getting him into those situations. And he, you know, he really goes with it and goes for it. And it's great. I'm really happy. Like, I'm kind of looking forward to someday my kids being able to see their grandfather in that movie. Because he's awesome.
What was it like for you when your father was co-starring on Seinfeld and everybody was watching the show?
Well, you know, it really changed his life. I mean, he, you know, for years and years, my parents, you know, were successful as a comedy team, and, you know, did the Ed Sullivan Show, I think over 30 times, and nightclubs and TV shows and all of that, and they you know, did really, really well. But then I think when Seinfeld happened for my dad, it just changed people's perception of him, and it reached so many people. And I was really very, very happy to see that for him, because I think he's really deserving of it, as I think my mom is too. I mean, she hasn't had her Seinfeld, but she's an incredibly talented actress. And so, you know, and I think it's for him, you know, he thrives on work. I think he loves to work. It keeps him going. Then, you know, out of that came King of Queens for him. And people love him. He's a naturally funny human being. And he's incredibly loved from that show. And so it was great. It was great to see that.
Now, just something about movies that you've been in. You've been in a lot of, like, pretty broad comedies. But you've also been in movies that are very kind of quirky in their own way. I'm so sick of that word, but I don't know what other word to use. But they're also, like, in their own way, very sad. And I'm thinking here of Wes Anderson's film, The Royal Tenenbaums, and also of your new movie, Greenberg. I mean, they're funny. They're about reasonably eccentric people, but there's a sadness underneath. I mean, whenever I see the Royal Tenenbaums, I mean, I'm kind of in tears at at the end. Mm. There's just something so emotional about it. And I guess I wonder if you've thought about that at all, about that undercurrent of sadness in some of the films that you've been in, even though there's something, you know,
right,
comic about them.
You know, I mean, I haven't thought about it in that way. I mean, I think that's what I really like about Royal Tenenbaums, that there is a real sort of emotional sort of vulnerability there. And I think in Greenberg, that world and the people in it, you know, I can relate to that. I feel like a lot of people can relate to that in terms of just trying to get through the day. You know, that's what I thought was sort of amazing about what Noah attempted in this movie, is that he really just tried to make a movie about real people trying to get through their lives every day with their sense of self intact and all. And it's hard, and, you know, it's lonely. And, you know, Greenberg, you can look at him as sort of like a guy who's, you know, really unhappy and hard to deal with and critical and, you know, and angry and all those things. But at the heart of it, he's a lonely guy who's looking for something, looking for a connection, and he doesn't have it. And that is really sad, I think, and kind of beautiful too. That what Noah decided to embrace in this movie. So I'm happy to be a part of that, and I like movies that are that open in that way.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too, Terry. Good talking to you.
Ben Stiller stars in the new movie Greenberg. You can find clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. The healthcare debate and last night's House vote passing healthcare reform brought President Lyndon Johnson to mind because of his work pushing through passage of Medicare and Medicaid. We're going to remember Liz Carpenter, who worked closely with him. She died Saturday at the age of 89. Carpenter began her career as a journalist covering Washington. She was Johnson's executive assistant when he was vice president. She was one of the first women to hold such a position. She wrote the 58-word text that Johnson read the evening President Kennedy was assassinated. She had been in the Kennedy motorcade. After LBJ became president, Carpenter became press secretary for Johnson's wife, Lady Bird. She later became active in women's rights issues. She was one of the founders of the National Women's Political Caucus and lobbied for passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. I spoke with Liz Carpenter in 1987, after the publication of her memoir. You wrote LBJ's speech after the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
That must have been a very difficult thing to write. I mean, who would know what to say after a national tragedy of that magnitude?
You know, it came, and I cannot say it came from in me. It came from above, or genes, something. But somehow at the time of a terrible day, you're called upon to be a survivor. And my role had been being a writer, writing remarks for LBJ. And so as we were moving out of Dallas to Air Force One, somehow my hand went into my purse, pulled out a pencil and a pad, knowing as a reporter that I had been, that he would be faced with a battery of reporters when we stepped off the plane in Washington, and he'd need some words. And so the words just began to come, and I don't think I rewrote them. I think that they just came, and without any real conscious effort, and I can't help but feel they were God-given. And this was true also, I think, to other people. All of us were moving around in a sort of a trauma. We still trying to reject what had happened. And I remember the two wire service reporters just automatically moved to telephones at Parkland Hospital and grabbed the phones. But that's their profession telling them, more than any conscience effort. The White House photographer knew he had to have the picture of the swearing in, and he set about doing that. So you kind of went about your work in a trance.
You started that message for Johnson with a very simple and very moving line. You wrote, "This is a sad time for all people."
Yes.
What did you open with that?
I started thinking this is a sad time for all Americans, but Kennedy was beloved around the world, and so it seemed to be too limiting.
So you came up with, "This is a sad time
for all Americans." And for all people. And then I ask your help and God's at the end.
You became Lady Bird's press secretary, and you say that you saw the job as helping her help him, of helping the First Lady, help the president.
That encompasses everything, doesn't it?
Well, but I wonder, what can you really do as the press secretary for the First Lady? What's your best way of helping the president?
Well, by making her his translator, and he deserved one, and president is terribly busy doing their things, and Lady Bird could go out and walk through the Head Start projects in Newark, New Jersey, or the Job Corps in Kentucky, and she had been a reporter herself briefly, but she had been a trained journalist with a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Texas. So she really knew what the 5 W's and the H are. She knew the difference between an AM and a PM. And if she could go and help kind of be the catalyst that brought out the story of what the kids in Head Start were like before and after the program, it certainly was helpful in selling the program to Congress and to the people.
What were some of the greatest crises that you had to cope with as press secretary to the First Lady?
Well, two that kind of dropped in on me were the weddings of the two daughters. And this is because I'm not by nature a press spokesman about weddings, but I was thrust into that. And there were about 85 to 100 women reporters who were eager to know every tedious detail about the plans for the weddings. And it was a joyous kind of relief, I think, from the steady barrage of stories about Vietnam that were certainly full of our front pages. And all the world does love a lover, so romance was ripe in the White House, and that was some of it. That you would get cornered on small things like, did Lucy's wedding gown have a union label in it? And this would be drop out of the sky. You didn't even know, and you have to find out, did it? And if it didn't, it better.
When you were first secretary to Lady Bird Johnson, I'm sure that there were plenty of times when she was out on one of her beautification campaigns when she was met by anti-war demonstrators, and when that became a part of the story that the press covered. Actually, I'm sure you must have run into that a lot, where anti-war demonstrations were receiving more coverage than the message that you and she wanted to get out. What was your stand on the war then?
Well, after 1966, when things began to get worse in Vietnam and you were getting more demonstrators, well, that's when the signs began to go up. And she would be out trying to tell not just about beautification, but about many other things like the war on poverty. And suddenly these signs would appear. And the newswomen would just, and the picture would be the sign. All you did was try to plead with them. You could not manage their news, but you would try to hope that somehow the story of the Job Corps camp, of the boy that had been improved by it, would get in. But often it was taken away from you, and that made it very difficult and discouraging. But she still kept on keeping on.
You found out that Johnson was resigning, like most of us did, by watching television.
Yeah,
you saw the speech. And later learned that his speech had two endings, one in which he resigned and one which he didn't.
That's the one I'd read earlier that afternoon.
The one in which he didn't resign.
Didn't.
Well, did you feel angry that you had to find out about this from television?
Not at all. I went right down to the White House. A Lady Bird called me and said they'd wanted to tell me. And they made a point of calling staff real quickly after the broadcast so you wouldn't have this. But I was sorry that he decided not to, because I think that, we went into the Nixon period, and so, and ultimately Watergate. But it would have been tough for him to get reelected, because as he realized, he was not the person to rally people together when everyone was so divided on Vietnam.
Liz Carpenter recorded in 1987. She died Saturday at the age of 89. This is Fresh Air. Claire Harmon has written acclaimed biographies of the novelists Sylvia Townsend Warner and Fanny Burney. In her latest book, Jane's Fame, Harmon considers the mostly posthumous career of the biggest female novelist of them all, Jane Austen. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
At her death in 1817, at age 41, Jane Austen had published four novels, anonymously, which had sold a few thousand copies. A few years later, those novels, along with two more published posthumously, were out of print. Austen's reputation, compared to that of her contemporaries, blockbuster lady novelists like Fanny Burney, and swaggering celebs like Sir Walter Scott and Lord Byron, was faint as the candlelight in the sitting room of the cottage she shared during the final years of her short life with her mother, sister, and a close friend. There, according to the now famous legend, Austen scratched out her novels, modestly concealing the latest pages of Emma or Mansfield Park whenever a squeaking hall door alerted her to the casual interruptions of servants or visitors or any persons beyond her own family party. Austen's first biographer, her nephew James Edward Austen Lee, drummed in this reassuring image of Austen as a mouse, who wrote without regard to fame or fortune when he equated her writing to her skill with embroidery. In his 1869 biographical sketch of Aunt Jane, Austen Lee approvingly noted that the same hand which painted so exquisitely with the pen could work as delicately with the needle. Can you hear the chortling from beyond the grave? That's Austen, or at least the Austen Claire Harmon gives us in her lively new book called Jane's Fame. Harmon's Austen is a dogged literary workhorse who coveted the bottom line of big sales. After Pride and Prejudice was published in 1813 and the secret of its author's identity began to leak out, Austen wrote to her sailor brother Frank that the secret has spread so far as to be scarcely the shadow of a secret now, and I believe whenever the third novel appears, I shall try to make all the money rather than all the mystery I can of it. People shall pay for their knowledge if I can make them. Harmon's shrewd critical study, brimming with Brit wit, freshens up our impression of Austen, an enterprise always hampered by the overarching fact that Austen's life, like Shakespeare's, left behind few biographical fossils, not even a decent portrait to bow down before and worship. The primary aim of Jane's Fame, however, is to tackle the great literary mystery of how this parson's daughter, who was happy to limit her scope to three or four families in a country village, came to conquer the world. With nimble steps, Harmon dances through 200 years' worth of critical reception of Austen's novels, sharing the good, the bad, and the brainless. Austen's own mother thought her son James, a failed poet, was the real writer in the family. Oh, Mom. And then there were those like Mark Twain who found Austen's work representative of the most stultifying aspects of English literary taste. Twain growled, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and hit her over the skull with her own shin bone." But even during the bleak half-century between Austen's death and the publication of her nephew's biography, when Austen's cool, ironic sensibility seemed so out of fashion with Victorian earnestness, Austen was admired by a discerning few. After the biography was published, the first wave of Austen mania hit, with Janeites like Rudyard Kipling and the Bloomsbury set leading the cheers. Subsequently, she's become the darling of feminists, queer theorists, merry old England hucksters, post-colonial critics, romance addicts, and pornographers. The 1990s witnessed another variant on Janeite fanaticism with the proliferation of Austen films, which Harmon says maximized the erotic potential in Austen's novels. Think of Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy in that dripping wet shirt, and you know she's right. Harmon's informed and elegant chronicle of the rise of Divine Jane, as the late Victorians called her, is an eye-opener. The fact that Austen's posthumous success is also an affirmation of the ideal of a literary meritocracy, the notion that the canonical cream always rises to the top, makes Jane's fame as happy a fairy tale as any of Austen's own novels.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Jane's Fame by Clear Harmon. I'm Terry Gross, and I'd like to end today's show by wishing Stephen Sondheim a happy 80th birthday, and I want to thank him for his extraordinary music.